The plane was mounted above the ground, the landing gear was free to retract and extend. It would happen a dozen times that night. Outside the hangar, she heard the electrician still talking in a worried tone. Teddy laughed, and the electrician said something else. Casey turned on her flashlight and moved forward. The flashlight cast a powerful glow. She twisted the rim, spreading the beam wider. Now the landing gear was fully raised. Then the gear doors opened, and the landing gear began to extend, the big rubber wheels coming down flat, then turning with a hydraulic whine. A moment later, the insignia light shone up at the rudder, illuminating the tail. Then it went off again. She headed for the aft accessory compartment in the tail. She knew Ron had said the QAR wasn't there, but she felt she had to check again. She climbed the broad stairs, rolled up to the back of the plane, being careful not to touch the handrails. Electrical test cables were taped to the handrails. She didn't want to disturb them or to cause field fluctuation from the presence of her hand. The aft accessory compartment, built into the upward slope of the tail, was directly above her head. The compartment doors were open. She shone her light in. The upper surface of the compartment was taken up by the underside of the APU, the turbine generator that served as the auxiliary power unit. A maze of semicircular pipes and white couplings wrapped around the main unit. Below was a cramped series of readout meters, rack slots, and black FCX boxes, each with the milled vanes for heat transfer. If there was a QAR in here as well, she might easily miss it. The QARs were only about 8 inches square. She paused to put on her goggles and turned on the CD player. Immediately a diagram of the aft accessory compartment hung in space before her eyes. She could see through the diagram to the actual compartment behind. The rectangular block marking the QAR was outlined in red on the diagram. In the actual compartment, the space was taken up by an extra readout meter, hydraulic pressure for a flight control system. Ron was right. There was no QAR here. Casey climbed back down the stairs to the floor and walked beneath the plane to the forward accessory compartment just behind the nose wheel. It, too, was open. Standing on the ground, she shone her flashlight up into the compartment and flicked to the correct manual page. A new image hung in the air. It showed the QAR located in the right anterior electrical rack, next to the hydraulic activator buses. It wasn't there. The slot was empty, the round connector plug exposed at the back, the shiny metal contact points glinting. It had to be somewhere inside the plane. She headed off to the right, where a roll-up staircase led up 30 feet to the passenger door just behind the cockpit. She heard her feet ring on the metal as she entered the aircraft. It was dark. She shone her flashlight aft, the beam moving over the cabin. The passenger cabin looked worse than before. In many places her beam caught the dull silver of the insulation pads. The electrical crews had pulled the interior panels around the windows to get at junction boxes along the walls. She noticed a lingering, faint odor of vomit. Someone had tried to mask it with a sweet floral spray. Behind her, the cockpit suddenly glowed. The overhead map lights came on, softly illuminating the two seats. Then the row of video display screens, the twinkling lights of the overhead panels. The FDAU printer on the pedestal buzzed, printing out a couple of test lines, then was silent. All the cockpit lights went out. Dark again. Cycling. Immediately, the forward galley lights just ahead of her came on. The illuminators for heating and microwaves flashed. The overheat and timer warnings beeped. Then everything went off. Silence. Dark again. Casey was still standing just inside the door, fiddling with the CD player at her waist, when she thought she heard footsteps. She paused, listening. It was difficult to tell. As the electrical systems cycled through, there was a continuous succession of soft buzzes and clicks from relays and solenoids in the avionics racks around her. She listened hard. Yes, she was sure of it now. Footsteps. Someone was walking slowly, steadily, through the hangar. Frightened, she leaned out the door and called loudly, "Teddy, is that you?" She listened. No more footsteps. Silence. The clicking of the relays. The hell with it, she decided. She was up here, alone, inside this torn-up airplane, and it was getting on her nerves. She was tired. She was imagining things. She walked around the galley to the left side, where the display showed an additional electrical storage panel down near the floor. The panel cover had already been removed. She looked at it through the transparent diagram. This was mostly taken up with secondary avionics boxes, and there was little room. No QAR. She moved down the cabin to the midship's bulkhead. There was a small storage compartment here built into the bulkhead frame just below a slot for magazines. It was a foolish place to install a QAR, she thought, and she was not surprised when she didn't find one there either. 4 down, 26 to go. Now she moved toward the tail, to the aft interior storage compartment. This was a more likely place. A square service panel that was just to the left of the rear exit door on the side of the aircraft. The panel didn't screw down, it flipped up on a hinge, which made it more accessible for crews in a hurry. She came to the door, which was open. She felt a cool breeze. Darkness outside. She couldn't see the ground 40 feet below. The panel was just to the left of the door, and it was already open. She looked, seeing it through the diagram. If the QAR was there, it would be in the lower right corner next to the breaker switches for the cabin lights and the crew intercom. It wasn't there. The wingtip lights came on, brilliant strobes flashing repeatedly. They cast harsh shadows in the interior through the open door and the row of windows, then off again. Clink. She froze. The sound had come from somewhere near the cockpit. It was a metallic sound, like a foot kicking a tool. She listened again. She heard a soft tread, a creak. Someone was in the cabin. She pulled the goggles off her head, leaving them hanging around her neck. Silently, she slid to her right, crouching behind a row of seats at the rear of the plane. She heard footsteps coming closer, a complicated pattern of sound, a murmur. Was there more than one? She held her breath. The cabin lights came on, first in front, then midships, then aft. But most of the ceiling lights were hanging, so they cast odd shadows, then went off again. She gripped the flashlight. The weight felt comforting in her hand. She moved her head to the right so she could peer between the seats. She heard the footsteps again, but could see nothing. Then the landing lights came on, and in their reflected glare a row of hot ovals appeared on the ceiling from the windows along both sides. And a shadow blotting out the ovals one after another. Someone walking down the aisle. Not good, she thought. What could she do? She had the flashlight in her hand, but she had no illusions about her ability to defend herself. She had her cell phone, her beeper, her... She reached down and silently flicked the beeper off. The man was close now. She edged forward, her neck aching, and she saw him. He was almost to the rear of the plane, looking in every direction. She could not see his face, but in the reflected landing lights, she could see his red-checked shirt. The landing lights went out. Darkness in the cabin. She held her breath. She heard the faint thunk of a relay coming from somewhere in the forward compartment. She knew it was electrical, but apparently the man in the red shirt did not. He grunted softly, as if surprised, and moved forward quickly. She waited. After a while, she thought she heard the sound of footsteps on the metal stairs going down. She wasn't sure, but she thought so. The airplane was silent around her. Cautiously, she came out from behind the seat. It was time to get out of here, she thought. She moved to the open door, listening. There was no question, the footsteps walking away, the sound diminishing. The nose lights came on, and she saw a long streak of shadow. A man walking away. A voice inside said, "Get out of here," but she felt the goggles around her neck and hesitated. She ought to give the man plenty of time to leave the hangar. She didn't want to go down and find him on the floor. So she decided to look in another compartment. She pulled on the goggles, pressed the button on the unit. She saw the next page. The next compartment was nearby, located just outside the rear door where she was standing. She leaned out the door, and holding on with her right hand, found she could easily look into the panel box. The cover was already open. There were three vertical rows of electrical buses, which probably controlled the two rear doors. They were overrides. And at the bottom? Yes. The quick access recorder. It was green with a white stripe around the top. Stenciled lettering, Maintenance QAR-041B Maintenance. A metal box about 8 inches square with a plug facing outward. Casey reached in, gripped the box, and pulled gently. With a metallic click, it came free of the inner coupling, and she had it in her hand. All right. She stepped back inside the doorway, holding the box in both hands now. She was so excited she was trembling. This changed everything. She was so excited she did not hear the rush of footsteps behind her until it was too late. Strong hands shoved against her. She grunted, and her hand slipped away, and then her body fell through the door into space, falling to the floor 30 feet below. Too soon, much too soon, she felt a sharp pain on her cheek, and then her body landed, but something was wrong. There were strange pressure points all over her body. She was no longer falling, but rising, then falling again. It was like a giant hammock. The webbing. She'd hit the safety webbing. She couldn't see it in the darkness, but the black safety webbing was hung beneath the plane, and she had fallen into it. Casey rolled over onto her back, saw a silhouette at the door. The figure turned and ran through the airplane. She scrambled to her feet, but it was difficult to balance. The webbing was slowly undulating. She moved forward toward the dull metal expanse of the wing. She heard footsteps clattering on the metal stairs somewhere forward. The man was coming. She had to get out. She had to get off the webbing before he caught her. She moved closer to the wing, and then she heard a cough. It had come from the far edge of the wing, somewhere off to her left. Someone else was here, down on the floor, waiting. She paused, feeling the gentle swaying of the webbing beneath her. In a moment, she knew more lights would come on. Then she could see where the man was. Suddenly, the hot strobe lights above the tail flickered rapidly. They were so bright, they illuminated the entire hangar. Now she could see who had coughed. It was Richman. He wore a dark blue windbreaker and dark slacks. The lazy, collegiate manner was gone. Richman stood near the wing, tense, alert. He looked left and right, carefully scanning the floor. Abruptly, the strobe lights went out, plunging the hangar into darkness. Casey moved forward, hearing the webbing creak beneath her feet. Would Richman hear? Could he figure out where she was? She came to the wing, stretching forward in darkness. She grabbed it with her hand, moved outward to the edge. Sooner or later, she knew the webbing would end. Her foot struck a thick cord. She bent down, felt knots. Casey lay down on the webbing, gripped the edge in both hands, and rolled over the side, falling. For a moment she hung by one arm, the webbing stretching downward. She was surrounded by blackness. She did not know how far it was to the floor. 6 feet? 10 feet? Running footsteps. She released the webbing and fell. She hit the ground standing, dropped to her knees. Sharp pain in her kneecap as she banged into concrete. She heard Richman cough again. He was very close, off to her left. She got up and began to run toward the exit door. The landing lights came on again, harsh and strong. In their glare, she saw Richman throw up his hands to cover his eyes. She knew he would be blinded for a few seconds, not long. But perhaps enough. Where was the other man? She ran. She hit the wall of the hangar with a dull metallic thud. Someone behind her said, "Hey!" She moved along the wall, feeling for the door. She heard running footsteps. Where? Where? Behind her, running footsteps. Her hand touched wood, vertical runners, more wood, then the metal bar. The door latch. She pushed. Cool air. She was outside. Teddy turned. "Hey, babe," he said, smiling. How's it going? She fell to her knees, gasping for breath. Teddy and the electrical guy came running over. What is it? What's the matter? They were standing over her, touching her, solicitous. She tried to catch her breath. She managed to gasp, Call security.
What?
Call security. Someone's inside. The electrical guy ran to the phone. Teddy stayed with her. Then she remembered the QAR. She had a moment of sudden panic. Where was it? She stood.
Oh, no, she said. I dropped it.
Dropped what, babe?
That box. She turned, looking back at the hangar. She'd have to get them to go back inside to...
You mean the one in your hand? Teddy said.
She looked at her left hand. The QAR was there, clutched so tightly, her fingers were white. Glendale, 11:30 p.m.
Come on now, Teddy said, arm around her, walking her into the bedroom. Everything's fine, babe.
Teddy, she said, I don't know why.
We'll find out tomorrow, he said soothingly.
But what was he doing?
Tomorrow, Teddy said.
But what was he...
She couldn't finish her sentences. She sat on the bed, suddenly feeling her exhaustion, overwhelmed by it.
I'll stay on the couch, he said. I don't want you alone tonight.
He looked at her, chucked her on the chin.
Don't worry about a thing, babe.
He reached over and took the QAR out of her hand. She released it unwillingly.
We'll just put this right here, he said, setting it on the bedside table.
He was talking to her as to a child.
Teddy, it's important.
I know. It'll be there when you wake up, okay?
Okay.
Call if you need anything.
He left, closing the door. She looked at the pillow. She had to get out of her clothes, get ready for bed. Her face hurt. She didn't know what had happened to it. She needed to look at her face.
She picked up the QAR and stuck it behind the pillow. She stared at the pillow, then lay down on it and closed her eyes. Just for a moment, she thought. Glendale, 6:30 a.m.
Something was wrong.
Casey sat up quickly. Pain streaked through her body. She gasped. She felt a burning sensation in her face. She touched her cheek and winced. Sunlight poured through her window onto the foot of the bed. She looked down at twin arcs of grease on the bedspread. She still had her shoes on. She still had her clothes on. She was lying on top of the bedspread, fully dressed. Groaning, she twisted her body, swung her feet to the floor. Everything hurt. She looked down at the bedside table. The clock said 6:30. She reached behind the pillow, brought out the green metal box with a white stripe. The QAR. She smelled coffee. The door opened and Teddy came in with his boxer shorts, bringing her a mug.
How bad is it?
Everything hurts.
I figured.
He held the coffee out to her. Can you handle this?
She nodded, took the mug carefully. Her shoulders hurt as she lifted it to her lips. The coffee was hot and strong.
Face isn't too bad, he said, looking at her critically. Mostly on the side. I guess that's where you hit the mesh.
She suddenly remembered. The interview.
Oh, Jesus, she said.
She got off the bed, groaning again.
3 aspirins, Teddy said, and a very hot bath.
I don't have time.
Make time, hot as you can stand.
She went into the bathroom and turned on the shower. She looked in the mirror. Her face was streaked with grime. There was a purple bruise that started by her ear and ran back behind her neck. Her hair would cover it, she thought. It wouldn't show. She took another drink of coffee, removed her clothes, got into the shower. She had bruises on her elbow, on her hip, on her knees. She couldn't remember how she had gotten them. The stinging hot spray felt good. When she came out of the shower, the telephone was ringing. She pushed open the door.
Don't answer that, Casey said. Are you sure?
There's no time, she said. Not today. She went into the bedroom to dress. She had only 10 hours until her interview with Marty Reardon. Between now and then, she had only one thing she wanted to do.
Clear up, Flight 545.
Norton, DDS, 7:40 a.m. Rob Wong placed the green box on the table, attached a cable, pressed a key on his console. A small red light glowed on the QAR box.
"It's got power," Wong said.
He sat back in his chair, looked at Casey.
"You ready to try this?"
"I'm ready," she said.
"Keep your fingers crossed," Wong said. He pushed a single key on the keyboard.
The red light on the QAR box began to flicker rapidly. Uneasily, Casey said, "Is that?"
"It's okay, it's downloading."
After a few seconds, the red light glowed steadily again.
"Now what?"
"It's done," Wong said. "Let's see the data."
His screen began to show columns of numbers. Wong leaned forward, looking closely.
Looks pretty good, Casey. This could be your lucky day."
He typed rapidly at the keyboard for several seconds, then he sat back.
"Now we see how good it is."
On the monitor, a wireframe aircraft appeared and rapidly filled in, becoming solid, three-dimensional. A sky-blue background appeared. A silver aircraft, seen horizontally in profile, the landing gear down. Wong punched keys, moving the aircraft around so they saw it from the tail. He added a green field running to the horizon and a gray runway. The image was schematic but effective. The airplane began to move, going down the runway. It changed attitude, the nose raising up, the landing gear folded into the wings.
"You just took off," Wong said. He was grinning.
The aircraft was still rising. Wong hit a key, and a rectangle opened on the right side of the screen. A series of numbers appeared, changing quickly.
"It's not a DFDR, but it's good enough," Wong said. "All the major stuff is here. Altitude, airspeed, heading, fuel, deltas on control surfaces, flaps, slats, ailerons, elevators, rudder, everything you need. And the data's stable, Casey."
The aircraft was still climbing. Wong hit a button, and white clouds appeared. The plane continued upward through the clouds.
"I figure you don't want to real-time this," he said. "You know when the accident occurred?"
"Yes," she said. "It was about 9:40 into the flight."
9:40 elapsed?
"Right.
Coming up."
On the monitor, the aircraft was level, the rectangle of numbers on the right stable. Then a red light began to flash among the numbers.
"What's that?"
"Fault recording. It's, slats disagree."
She looked at the aircraft on the screen. Nothing changed. "Slats extending?"
"No," Wong said. "Nothing. It's just a fault."
She watched a moment longer. The aircraft was still level. 5 seconds passed. Then the slats emerged from the leading edge.
"Slats extending," Wong said, looking at the numbers. "And then, slats fully extended."
Casey said, "So there was a fault first, and then the slats extended afterward."
"Right."
"Uncommanded extension?"
"No, commanded. Now the plane nose goes up and..." "Uh-oh. Exceeding buffet boundary. Now here's the stall warning, and..."
On the screen, the airplane nosed over into a steep dive. The white clouds streaked past faster and faster. Alarms began to beep, flashing on the screen.
"What's that?" Casey said.
"The plane's exceeding the G-load envelope. Geez, look at 'em."
The airplane pulled out of the dive and began a steep climb.
"He's going up at 16, 18, 21 degrees, Wong said, shaking his head.
21 degrees?
On commercial flights, the standard rate of climb was 3 to 5 degrees. 10 degrees was steep, used only in takeoffs. At 21 degrees, passengers would feel as if the plane were going straight up. More alarms.
"Exceedances," Wong said again in a flat voice. "He's stressing the hell out of the airframe. It's not built to take that. You guys do a structure inspect?"
As they watched, the plane went into a dive again.
"I can't believe this," Wong said. "The autopilot's supposed to prevent that."
He was on manual.
"Even so, these wild oscillations would kick in the autopilot."
Wong pointed to the box of data to one side. Yeah. There it is. The autopilot tries to take over. Pilot keeps punching it back to manual. That's crazy. Another climb. Another dive. In all, they watched aghast as the aircraft went through 6 cycles of dive and climb, until suddenly, abruptly, it returned to stable flight.
What happened? She said.
Autopilot took over, finally. Rob Wong gave a long sigh. Well, I'd say you know what happened to this airplane, Casey, but I'm damned if I know why.
War Room, 9 a.m.
A cleaning crew was at work in the war room. The big windows overlooking the factory floor were being washed, the chairs and the formica table wiped down. In the far corner, a woman was vacuuming the carpet. Daugherty and Ron Smith were standing near the door looking at a printout.
What's going on? She said.
No IRT today, Daugherty said. Martyr canceled it.
Casey said, How come nobody told me that?
Then she remembered. She turned her beeper off the night before. She reached down, turned it back on.
CET test last night was damn near perfect, Ron said. Just as we said all along, that's an excellent airplane. We only got 2 repeated faults. We got a consistent fault on AUX COA, starting 5 cycles in around 10:30. I don't know why that happened.
He looked at her, waiting. He must have heard that she'd been inside the hangar the night before at about that time. But she wasn't going to explain it to him. At least not right now, she said.
And what about the proximity sensor?
That was the other fault, Smith said. Out of 22 cycles we ran during the night, the wing proximity sensor faulted 6 times. It's definitely bad.
And if that proximity sensor faulted during flight,
you'd get a slat. Disagree. In the cockpit.
She turned to leave.
Hey, Daugherty said. Where are you going?
I've got to look at some video.
Casey, do you know what the hell's going on?
You'll be the first to know, she said, and she walked away. As swiftly as the investigation had stalled the day before, she felt it coming together. The QAR had been the key. At last she could reconstruct the sequence of events on Flight 545, and with that the pieces of the puzzle were falling rapidly into place. As she walked to her car, she called Norma on her cell phone.
Norma, I need a route schedule for Trans-Pacific.
Got one right here, Norma said. It came over with the FAA packet. What do you want to know?
Flight schedule to Honolulu.
I'll check. There was a pause.
They don't go into Honolulu, Norma said. They only go to...
Never mind, Casey said. That's all I needed to know. It was the answer she had expected.
Listen, Norma said. Martyr has called 3 times for you already. He says you're not answering your pager. Tell him you can't reach me. And Richmond has been trying to...
You can't reach me, Casey said. She hung up and hurried to her car. Driving in the car, she called Ellen Fong in accounting. The secretary said Ellen was working at home again today. Casey got the number and called.
Ellen, it's Casey Singleton.
Oh, yes, Casey. Her voice was cool, careful. Did you do the translation? Casey said.
Yes.
Flat, no expression. Did you finish it?
Yes, I finished it.
Can you fax it to me? Casey said. There was a pause.
I don't think I should do that, Ellen said. All right.
Do you know why? Ellen Fong asked. I can guess.
I will bring it to your office, Ellen said.
2 o'clock? Fine, Casey said. The pieces were coming together, fast.
Casey was now pretty sure she could explain what happened on Flight 545. She could almost lay out the entire chain of causal events. With luck, the tape and video imaging would give her her final confirmation.
Only one question remained. What was she going to do about it? Sepulveda Boulevard, 10:45 a.m. Fred Barker was sweating. The air conditioner was turned off in his office, and now, under Marty Reardon's insistent questioning, sweat trickled down his cheeks, glistened in his beard, dampened his shirt.
"Mr. Barker," Marty said, leaning forward.
Marty was 45, handsome in a thin-lipped, sharp-eyed way. He had the air of a reluctant prosecutor, a seasoned man who'd seen it all. He spoke slowly, often in short fragments, with the appearance of reasonableness. He was giving the witness every possible break, and his favorite tone was that of disappointment, dark eyebrows up. How could this be? Marty said, "Mr. Barker, you've described problems with the Norton N-22, but the company says airworthiness directives were issued that fixed the problem. Are they right?"
"No."
Under Marty's probing, Barker had dropped the full sentences. He now said as little as possible.
"The directives didn't work?"
"Well, we just had another incident, didn't we, involving slats?"
"Norton told us it wasn't slats."
"I think you'll find it was."
"So Norton Aircraft is lying?"
"They're doing what they always do. They come up with some complicated explanation that conceals the real problem."
"Some complicated explanation," Marty repeated.
"But aren't aircraft complicated?"
"Not in this case. The accident is the result of their failure to redress a long-standing design flaw."
"You're confident of that?"
"Yes."
"How can you be so sure? Are you an engineer?"
"No."
"You have an aerospace degree?"
"No."
"What was your major in college?"
"That was a long time ago."
"Wasn't it music, Mr. Barker? Weren't you a music major?"
"Well, yes, but,
Jennifer watched Marty's attack with mixed feelings. It was always fun to see an interview squirm, and the audience loved to watch pompous experts cut down to size. But Marty's attack threatened to devastate her entire segment. If Marty destroyed Barker's credibility, of course, she thought, she could work around him. She didn't have to use him.
"A Bachelor of Arts. In music," Marty said in his reasonable tone.
"Mr. Barker, do you think that qualifies you to judge aircraft?"
"Not in itself, but you have other degrees?"
"No."
"Do you have any scientific or engineering training at all?"
Barker tugged at his collar.
"Well, I worked for the FAA.
"Did the FAA give you any scientific or engineering training? Did they teach you, say, fluid dynamics?"
"No."
"Aerodynamics?"
"Well, I have a lot of experience."
"I'm sure.
But do you have formal training in aerodynamics, calculus, metallurgy, structural analysis, or any of the other subjects involved in making an airplane?"
"Not formally, no."
"Informally?"
"Yes, certainly, a lifetime of experience."
"Good, that's fine. Now, I notice those books behind you and on your desk."
Reardon leaned forward, touched one of the books that lay open.
"This one here, it's called Advanced Structural Integrity Methods for Airframe Durability and Damage Tolerance." "Pretty dense. You understand this book?"
"Most of it, yes."
"For example," Reardon pointed to the open page, turned it to read. "Here on page 807, it says levers and radon introduced a biaxiality parameter B that relates the magnitude of the T-stress as in equation 5. You see that?"
"Yes,"
Barker swallowed. "What is a biaxiality parameter?"
Well, it's rather difficult to explain briefly."
Marty jumped.
"Who are levers and radon?"
"They're researchers in the field."
"You know them?"
"Not personally."
"But you're familiar with their work?"
"I've heard their names."
"Do you know anything about them at all?"
"Not personally, no."
"Are they important researchers in the field?"
"I've said I don't know."
Barker tugged at his collar again.
Jennifer realized she had to put a stop to this. Marty was doing his attack dog routine, snarling at the smell of fear. Jennifer couldn't use any of this stuff. The significant fact was that Barker had been on a crusade for years. He had a track record. He was committed to the fight.
In any case, she already had his slats explanation from the day before, and she had softball answers to the questions she had asked herself. She tapped Marty on the shoulder. "We're running late," she said. Marty responded instantly. He was bored. He jumped up.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Barker. We have to cut this short. We appreciate your time. You've been very helpful."
Barker appeared to be in shock. He mumbled something. The makeup girl came up to him with wipes in her hand and said, "I'll help you get the makeup off." Marty Reardon turned to Jennifer. In a low voice, he said, "What the fuck are you doing?"
"Marty," she said, answering him in the same low tones, "the CNN tape is dynamite. The story's dynamite. The public's scared to get on airplanes. We're flushing out the controversy, performing a public service."
"Not with this clown, you're not," Reardon said. "He's a litigator's stooge. All he's good for is an out-of-court settlement. He doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about."
"Marty, whether you like this guy or not, the plane has a history of problems, and the tape is fabulous."
"Yes, and everybody's seen the tape," Reardon said. "But what's the story? You better show me something, Jennifer."
"I will, Marty."
"You better."
Left unstated was the rest of the sentence. "Or I'm going to call Dick Schenck and pull the plug." Aviation Highway, 11:15 a.m. For a different look, they shot the FAA guy on the street with the airport as background. The FAA guy was skinny and wore glasses. He blinked rapidly in the sun. He looked weak and bland. He was such a non-entity, Jennifer couldn't even remember his name. She felt confident he wouldn't hold up well. Unfortunately, he was devastating about Barker. "The FAA handles a great deal of sensitive information. Some is proprietary, some is technical, some is industry-sensitive, and some is company-sensitive. Since the candor of all parties is critical to our function, we have very strict rules about the dissemination of this information. Mr. Barker violated those rules. He seemed to have a great desire to see himself on television and his name in the newspapers."
"Well, he says that's not true," Marty replied. "He says the FAA wasn't doing its job and he had to speak out."
"Two attorneys?"
Marty said, "Attorneys?"
"Yeah,"
the FAA guy said. "Most of his leaks were to attorneys bringing cases against carriers. He released confidential information to attorneys, incomplete information about investigations in progress. And that's illegal."
"Did you prosecute?"
"We're not able to prosecute. We don't have that authority. But it was clear to us that he was being paid under the table by lawyers to give them information. We turned his case over to the Justice Department, which failed to pursue it. We were pretty upset about it. We thought he should go to jail and the attorneys with him."
"Why didn't that happen?"
"You'd have to ask Justice. But the Justice Department is made up of attorneys, and attorneys don't like to send other attorneys to jail. Sort of professional courtesy. Barker worked for attorneys, and they got him off. Barker still works for attorneys. Everything he says is designed to support or incite a frivolous lawsuit. He has no real interest in aviation safety. If he did, he'd still be working for us, trying to serve the public instead of trying to make a lot of money."
Marty said, "As you know, the FAA is currently under fire."
Jennifer thought she'd better stop Marty now. There wasn't any point in continuing. She already intended to drop most of this interview. She'd used just the early statement where the FAA guy said Barker wanted publicity. That was the least damaging comment, and it would constitute a balanced response in the segment. Because she needed Barker. "Marty, I'm sorry. We have to get across town." Marty nodded, thanked the guy immediately. Another indication he was bored, signed an autograph for the guy's kid, and climbed into the limo ahead of Jennifer.
"Jesus," Marty said as the limo pulled away.
He waved goodbye to the FAA guy through the window, smiled to him, then he flopped back in the seat.
"I don't get it, Jennifer," he said ominously.
"Correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't have a story. You got some bullshit allegations by lawyers and they're paid stooges, but you've got nothing of substance."
"We've got a story," she said. "You'll see."
She tried to sound confident.
Marty grunted unhappily.
The car pulled out and headed north to the valley toward Norton Aircraft.
Video Imaging Systems, 11:17 a.m.
Tape's coming up now, Harmon said. He drummed his fingers on the console.
Casey shifted her body in the chair, feeling twinges of pain. She still had several hours before the interview. She still couldn't decide how she would handle it. The tape began to run. Harmon had tripled the frames, the image moving in a jerky slow motion. The change made the sequence appear even more horrifying. She watched in silence as the bodies tumbled, the camera spun and fell, and finally came to rest at the cockpit door.
Go back.
How far?
As slow as you can.
One frame at a time?
Yes.
The images ran backward. The gray carpet, the blur as the camera jumped away from the door, the glint of light off the open cockpit door, the hot glare from the cockpit windows, the shoulders of the two pilots on either side of the pedestal, captain on the left, first officer on the right. The captain reaching toward the pedestal.
Stop!
She stared at the frame. The captain was reaching, no hat, the face of the first officer turned forward, away from him. The captain reaching his hand out. Casey rolled her chair toward the console and peered at the monitor. Then she stood, moved very close to the screen, seeing the scan lines. There it is, she thought, in living color. But what was she going to do about it?
Nothing, she realized. There was nothing she could do. She had the information now, but she could not possibly release it and hold on to her job.
But she realized she was probably going to lose her job anyway. Marder and Edgerton had set her up to do the press. Whether she lied, as Marder wanted her to do, or whether she told the truth, she was in trouble. There was no way out. The only possible solution that Casey could see was not to do the interview, but she had to do it. She was caught in the middle.
Okay, she said, sighing. I've seen enough.
What do you want to do?
Run another copy.
Harmon pressed a button on the console. He shifted in his chair, looking uncomfortable. Ms. Singleton, he said, I feel I have to mention something. The people who work here have seen this tape, and frankly, they're pretty upset.
I can imagine, Casey said.
They've all seen that guy on television, the attorney who says you're covering up the real cause of the accident.
Uh-huh.
And one person in particular, a woman in reception, thinks we should turn this tape over to the authorities or to the television stations. I mean, it's like the Rodney King thing. We're sitting on a bomb here. People's lives are at risk.
Casey sighed.
She was not really surprised. But it presented a new issue, and she would have to deal with it.
Has that already happened? Is that what you're telling me?
No, Harmon said. Not yet.
But people are concerned.
Yes. And what about you? What do you think?
Well, to tell you the truth, I'm bothered as well, Harmon said. I mean, you work for the company, you have your loyalties, I understand that. But if there really is something wrong with this airplane and people died because of it...
Casey's mind was working fast again, thinking through the situation. There was no way to know how many copies of the tape had already been made. There was no way to contain or control events now. And she was tired of the intrigue, with the carrier, with the engineers, with the union, with Marder, with Richmond. All these conflicting agendas, while she was caught in the middle, trying to hold it together. And now the damn tape company. She said, "What's the name of the woman in reception?"
"Christine Barron."
"Does she know your company has signed a non-disclosure agreement with us?"
"Yeah, but I guess she thinks her conscience takes precedence."
"I need to make a call," Casey said, "on a private line." He took her to an office that wasn't being used. She made two telephone calls. When she came back, she said to Harmon, "The tape is Norton property. It is not to be released to anyone without our authorization, and you have signed a non-disclosure agreement with us."
"Doesn't your conscience bother you?" Harmon said.
"No," Casey said, "it doesn't. We're investigating this, and we'll get to the bottom of it. All you're doing is talking about things you don't understand. If you release this tape, you'll help a bottom-feeder lawyer sue us for damages.
You signed an NDA with us. You violate it, and you're out of business. Keep it in mind.
She took her copy of the tape and walked out of the room.
Norton QA, 11:50 a.m. Frustrated and angry, Casey stormed into her office at QA. An elderly woman was waiting for her.